You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
The idea of the civic university has its roots in the 19th century, when the U.S. established the land-grant universities in 1862, which expanded the opportunity for a higher education to a greater population by giving states land and money to set up public institutions. Around the same time in the UK, university colleges were established in growing industrial cities in the north, like Manchester and Birmingham, to provide an education to the local business class. Since the 1800s, the civic missions of universities have ebbed and flowed, but they've had a bit of a revival in recent years, taking more the form of public engagement, economic renewal, and community outreach. I'm Sarah Custer. Welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast, where today we'll be speaking with two people deeply involved in the civic activities at their institutions in the UK and in Canada. And of course, joining me today is my colleague, Miranda Prynne. Hello, Miranda.
Hi there. How are you?
Yeah, doing very well. It's good to see you again.
Yes, you too.
Miranda, I'll go first. So let me tell you about the University of Winnipeg Community Renewal Corporation in Canada and the CEO, Jeremy Reed, who I spoke with on Canada Day, coincidentally. Before he even began telling me about the development projects that they're working on, he started off emphasizing the history of the university within the city of Winnipeg and how the demographics of the local community have changed in the last 20 years. And it really underlined the idea of place in the conversation about civic universities and how important that is when we're talking about the impact they have on the world beyond their campuses. So that's where this interview starts.
Let me step back a little bit and maybe talk about, you know, what the origins of the Renewal Corporation were.
Yeah.
And what that means for our practice in an ongoing way. I think there is something important when we're talking about a Canadian institution and we're talking about an institution in Winnipeg, because I think with post-secondary institutions, each institution has its own context.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's tempting for us to believe that, you know, as institutions, educational institutions, we serve a public good, and that can give us a kind of carte blanche in the way in which we move in the world as institutions. But I think, you know, as, you know, the residential school experience for Indigenous populations in Canada have demonstrated, just because your ostensible purpose is education, that what you mean by education, how you carry out education, and what you do as an institution, the physical institution, and your embodiment matters. So when we think about the University of Winnipeg, which exists in historic Treaty One territory, in what is also Métis homeland in Canada, it's important, I think, to understand that context and also understand the history of education in Winnipeg and in the prairies in Canada, and understand, especially in Winnipeg, that has amongst the Canadian, major Canadian cities, one of, if not the highest proportion of Indigenous peoples and communities in the city itself. So I think that that's important context. University of Winnipeg is also in the core of Winnipeg's downtown, which, like many North American cities, is also kind of hollowed out in the latter half of the century, right? Kind of became a donut city, as many North American cities did. Mm. And so it sits in a fairly disinvested community as well. So it's a community that also has a high Indigenous population, urban Indigenous population, a high number of new Canadian and visible minority residents in its immediate community, and is also one of the poorest communities in Canada. And I think important to the history of the University of Winnipeg, it was the United Church College of the University of Manitoba that split off in 1967 to form its own institution. there's ecumenicism and also social gospel deep in its roots, which I think in more secular expression has led the university to have a more progressive intellectual bent. And I think in periods of its history also that's been trotted out in terms of its physical presence, including staying in the inner city when the rest of the University of Manitoba moved to the south end of the city of Winnipeg, kind of into suburbia. So University of Winnipeg. So there's a lot of context, Sarah, to what I'm about to say. So why was the University of Winnipeg Renewal Corporation created? Well, it was created really between in the late 90s, early 2000s. There was a kind of a large surge in U of W's population, student population. It increased by about 50% over a five-year period, in part because of Echo Boom, in part because of just participation rates in post-secondary increasing, and increasing particularly amongst Indigenous and newcomer students. And immigration had increased through the provincial nominee program. And so the population in Manitoba was growing. The historic boomer population was growing, and First Nations participation rates or Indigenous student participation rates were on the increase. So all of those things led to a real population boom at U of W over that period. And U of W already had one of the smallest per square foot per student footprints of Canadian institutions as it was, right? And so there was a real need for physical growth of the institution. And the board at the time identified that they needed to put about about $130 million in capital development into the campus. In that, they did two things. One, they spun out a couple of arm's length organizations. First of all, the U of W Foundation to take care of some of the fundraising. And then they hired Dwight Axworthy. He was Canada's former foreign affairs minister under the Chrétien government. And he had also been a minister in the Trudeau government before that, and was a Nobel Prize nominee. And, you know, from Winnipeg's North End, kind of come home after making an international reputation for himself and having people like Kofi Annan and Madeleine Albright in his Rolodex, right? President Axworthy, prior to his being hired as president, was actually a professor at U of Winnipeg, and was one of the founding instructors at the Urban Studies program. So they hired President Axworthy with this ambition to do some capital fundraising, and I think understanding that President Axworthy would have the kind of profile to help the institution succeed in that. And I think early on, President Axworthy identified a couple of things. One, he did recognize the context. I think he recognized the disinvested kind of nature of the community in which the university sat, and had a long history himself working with First Nations and quite sensitive to the needs of the community, including the need of many Indigenous students are non-sequential students. So they often come with families, et cetera, as do many newcomers when they come to university. And the university at the time really didn't have any residential accommodations to encourage families to be part of the residential setting in the institution. One of his first acts as president was to pull down the gate, the iron gate that sat outside the front line of the institution, right? As a signal to the community that they were welcome. And there were some things architecturally that the university had done in previous decades to really reinforce that sense of that's the community and this is the university. You know, including like the major recreational facility on the corner of the campus is all brick wall facing the community, right? And so I think there was an intentional understanding that the university needed to reorient itself to the community.
Right.
So they needed a developer who would understand that. And also I think it was a financial reality to, if you're going to undertake a decade of building, you could hire a bunch of developers and pay them fees, or create the capacity internally and save the institution some dollars, and also to develop the expertise to work with the academic community And so that's when we were created in 2006. The University of Winnipeg Community Renewal Corporation was created. The reality is, because of a very activist inner city community, I don't think the university could have undertaken the capital development goals that it had without, in, you know, consulting with the community, incorporating its interests. Otherwise, it wouldn't have the social license to undertake the campus development.
Right. One question that I also wanted to ask you, your experience of incorporating that community voice and working with the community, because I know on the board of directors, it's about pretty evenly split between university stakeholders and community stakeholders. And you've got someone from the Aboriginal Council of Winnipeg on there. You've also got someone who's from a brewery. What's been your experience in terms of, I guess, navigating those potentially choppy waters between university interests and community interests?
Yeah, well, for the first decade, I mean, it was only UWCRC. Our 2.0 entity is a latter creation, which is doing community development. But the campus developer, so I'll give you some examples. We talk about having a four-pillar model of sustainability. So, social, cultural, environmental, and financial. Mm-hmm. And by social, I think we mean more on the social inclusion and justice end. On cultural, not unlike what I was just speaking about, understanding your context and with whom you are working and to whom you are speaking and what the student body, what the composition of the student body is, and what the educational needs of the community are from a cultural perspective. And then environmental sustainability is, I mean, in some ways self-explanatory, right? The university has met all original Kyoto targets. And in our builds under the university developer, we were mandated to have at least LEED Silver at the time. And I think we delivered 3 LEED Silver and 2 LEED Gold projects. But let's talk about the RecPlex as an example. So the RecPlex was, for starters, the initial inception of it was actually thinking about it as an indoor hockey arena.
Mm-hmm.
And as the community was consulted and as we looked at what the University of Winnipeg required, we didn't have a hockey team at the time, for instance. But we also recognized that, like, hockey is a very expensive sport that's dominated by middle class and upper class white families in Canada. And in the context that we were in, new Canadians weren't playing hockey. They were playing soccer and basketball. And so there was a shifting from that vision of what the expansion of recreational facilities at the University of Winnipeg would look like responsive to the community. Mm-hmm. So instead of hockey, we have lacrosse, ultimate frisbee, you know, basketball and soccer happening inside the new RecPlex.
Mm-hmm.
The RecPlex itself includes a piece of public art, that was a collaboration with Ebb and Flow First Nation. We have in the RecPlex adjacent to a kind of multi-purpose, like, you know, basketball, volleyball gym, there's a multi-purpose room that has extra soundproofing for drumming and has extra ventilation to accommodate cultural ceremony smudging. And the building itself was LEED Gold. So in there, you can kind of see some of the social, cultural, and environmental pieces of our four pillars. And the RecPlex was intended to try to generate through rentals and the parkade that we built underneath it, actually, the revenues to support it, so it wasn't drawing on existing operating or becoming an operating draw full totem on the university's existing operating budget. The other thing we did in that building was work with the local community who had felt shut out from the previous Duckworth Athletic Center from the 80s, mm-hmm. that I described as having the walls all
mm-hmm.
blocked off in the community. And so indoor soccer fields are usually kind of barn-like. This building is not. And it actually has windows at grade around the entire building so as to be porous. That was quite intentional architectural pivot and design to say to the community, this is your place too. We also created a community charter that was modeled on the Vancouver Olympic Community Charter for its Olympic venues, that mm-hmm. one third of the time in the RecPlex would be devoted to community uses.
It sounds like it started about 16 years ago. It started really as a kind of internal in-house development body for the university. But tell us a
Exactly.
bit about the 2.0 version of it now, because it sounds like you're expanding those development services to the wider Winnipeg community.
Yeah. So, I mean, what happened is we developed just under $250,000 of infrastructure for the university over about a 12-year period. And towards the end of that, we undertook two developments that really started to push the margins of what is a university development with a community edge to a primarily community facility with some university attachment or none. So those two projects were the Merchants Corner Inc. So Merchants Corner is in Winnipeg, North Winnipeg is the poorest area in Winnipeg. There was a pub bar that was a problem for the local community. Lots of drug traffic, illicit traffic going through it. It was this issue of safety for the broader community. And a number of community organizations came to the university and said, "Hey, you've done a lot of development. Can you help us actually redo the infrastructure?" And so we worked with Manitoba Housing, and the university also has its inner city studies program located there as well, which has a high Indigenous content focus. So we worked with the community and acted as developers for a nonprofit that was created by the existing nonprofit community organization community organizations. And the university became tenant for one of the floors. There was still a university connection. There was a university educational program, but there was other educational programs and other community uses and other community voices, and it wasn't a university asset at play. So that was kind of step one. We also created the Downtown Commons, which was a mixed income, affordable house, 102 affordable housing unit building under UWCRC. 31 units of which across any price point were available to students. And so again, the university certainly had an interest in seeing something like more market housing, quality market housing in the neighborhood, that they had some sort of interest in control over. But we built it so that two-thirds of it was open to the broader public, and not all the affordable units were taken by university students. So that started to push the edge of, okay, there's university interest. And at the same time, we also had other post-secondaries, First Nations, and other nonprofits coming to us saying, "Hey, you've got a lot of development expertise. Can you help us?" And so we felt that we needed to create this new vehicle, so UWCRC 2.0. So if UWCRC, University of Winnipeg Community Renewal Corporation, was about university campus development, or 2.0 is really applying the development expertise of UWCRC to community asset development.
Tell me a little bit about how any impact the pandemic has had on UWCRC 2.0 or UWCRC, and just kind of how you're perhaps approaching those community relationships now.
Well, if anything, I think it's what heightens the need for us. Downtowns across North America, right, have seen this vacancy dip with everybody moving out, and especially in our context, campuses shutting down in the downtowns, and young people who are your traditional renters in the downtown, at least in our context, who are, underemployed at the moment, right? So we have felt that kind of pandemic impact. On the flip side, the government of Canada, as I'm sure is happening elsewhere, right, is engaged in a lot of stimulus spending and we're addressing immediate needs for housing, et cetera, coming out of the affordable housing, coming out of the pandemic. And so there's a number of infrastructure programs and green infrastructure programs in Canada's case, so a combination of both the social and the environmental. We're working with a couple of organizations who work with women and children fleeing domestic violence, for instance, who there's dollars available, but they don't have the development expertise, and so they've engaged us to assist them in trying to deliver product. So for us, COVID, I mean, outside of some lease-up impacts, has actually, I would say, highlighted a kind of niche that we're filling in the development world, because traditional developers aren't really, unless you're the state, right, unless you're the province developing social housing, it's not like the private sector development community, generally speaking, is all that interested in developing, you know, shelter beds. We want our clients and for our own projects for them to be financially sustainable, but we're not having to return 15% per annum to an investor either. And mostly, I hope that we also serve the educational purpose of the institution. So like the Merchants Hotel, you know, there's classrooms for inner city studies that include Indigenous perspectives. And in the new science building, there's Indigenous knowledge in the environment courses being taught, right? And at U of W now, for the last several years, we have mandatory Indigenous studies requirements regardless of your program of study. And we were one of the first institutions to do it. And I think, so there's the physical structure, and then there's, you know, what it's supporting, and hopefully not in the way in which, you know, hopefully our university students aren't experiencing what the generations ahead of them experienced at residential schools.
Yeah, and it is that feedback loop back into the university, which is a really crucial part of this whole ecosystem that you're creating with the community renewal endeavors.
Absolutely. That inner city kids from first generation Canadian families who will also ultimately be first in family post-secondary learners kick a soccer ball inside our university complex, because now the university isn't a foreign entity to them that they don't belong in, right? And maybe the same kid who at 8 years old is kicking a soccer ball in it realizes that they can do their pre-med studies at that same in their neighborhood school too.
So the University of Winnipeg Community Renewal Corporation is almost 20 years old now. I think a lot of universities are perhaps turning inward and kind of asking what role they're going to play as the world is emerging from this pandemic. What sort of advice would you give to other universities who are looking to grow the role that they have in their own community and have some real long-term impact?
I think if I were to give advice to other institutions, which in itself is a little bit presumptuous, but I think being very clear about what your motivations for engaging in development work in particular, and like real estate development work in particular, I think is really important, because I think if you are in it for financial returns, it will lead to a certain outcome. If you are in it for community engagement or responding to your context or providing opportunities for educational engagement with the community, inviting the community in rather than pushing existing community out, whatever the context. So in our context, we're in a certain context in Canada and a disinvested community, which I think creates some obligations for us as an institution in terms of how we work in our community. And I'm sure that is true of other institutions. And so I think understanding why you're in it and where you are, because you take up space, and how you move, especially in relation to communities that may be disinvested, is really important, because you are the elephant and the community is the mouse, or in many contexts, that's the case. And so I think it's important to understand both the promise of what has been called anchor institution-led development, in terms of being able to leverage and apply the resources of an institution for good purposes, but also understanding that the institution will have its interests, and the community's interests may not always perfectly align with the institutional interests. And there is a need to understand the interests of both, and an obligation, I think, on behalf of the institution, usually as the larger player, to ensure that its interests are becoming mutually reinforcing of the community's interests rather than antagonistic to them. And I think that can lead to unexpected and very valuable outcomes.
Some advice from Jeremy Reed at the University of Winnipeg Community Renewal Corporation at the end there about how universities should think about how to even start off any sort of community development work. And one thing that he mentioned that stood out for me there was universities just being aware of how they move and take up space within their communities, and just realizing that in a community, you are the elephant and the community is the mouse. Miranda, tell us who you spoke with for today's show.
Yeah, so I spoke to archaeologist and former Time Team presenter, Carenza Lewis.
And sorry, Miranda, just for us who didn't grow up in the UK, what is Time Teams?
So Time Team was a Channel 4 documentary based around archaeological digs. It was presented by Carenza Lewis and Tony Robinson, and there were quite a few other sort of expert archaeologists on the show. And yeah, they just focus in on various sites where they were kind of notable importance.
Great.
I absolutely loved it when I was younger.
Were you starstruck when you spoke with her?
I think I tend to try not to be starstruck. I don't think it's ever very helpful. And actually, I mean, what I should go on to say is Carenza's role at the University of Lincoln currently involves also helping her fellow academics shape their research to include more public engagement work. And when we spoke, she actually provided some really useful insight into kind of how they approach that. One of the points she made was that actually public engagement was no longer simply about supporting the local community, but also, you know, engaging and working with all sorts of communities. So she talked about communities of interest, communities of identity, you know, shared hobbies and so on. She felt that the focus of public engagement had actually been generally increasing in the past few decades. Mainly because of higher education's move away from a sort of top-down model of imparting knowledge into more of a knowledge-sharing model. Mm. And like Jeremy, she did point out that the pandemic has, you know, hugely accelerated the need, essentially, for this work. But she did also offer a silver lining with regards to COVID, which was that she felt the move to digital across higher education has opened up access to much wider audiences. Hello, I'm here with Carenza Lewis, an archaeologist and professor for the Public Understanding of Research at the University of Lincoln. She also leads Lincoln's PEARL project, which stands for Public Engagement for All with Research at Lincoln. This initiative, which I believe was launched in 2017, aims to help academics embed public engagement into their research. And finally, you may also remember Carenza as one of the original presenters of Channel 4's Time Team, which arguably is one of the best examples of bringing academic discipline into the public sphere. Welcome, Carenza. Great to speak to you today.
Thank you very much.
We're talking about civic engagement and how universities can better engage and inform the public in their teaching and research to ultimately increase their value to society. So, Carenza, I'd like to start by asking you, civic or public engagement is a very broad term. Can you perhaps break it down a bit for us into what you think are its key components?
Yes, well, as you say, it's a very broad term. I mean, kind of conventionally, civic engagement tends to be about focusing on the university's local communities, the civitas, if you like, classical terms, that the university is part of, the city or locality it's in. Whereas a sort of public engagement tends to be more about wider publics generally and often more focused on research. But the two are fairly conflated now because, of course, universities' communities aren't just their local communities, they're communities of interest or identity or experience. The sort of public engagement with research can be much wider than just research. It's about engagement with teaching as well. The aims of civic engagement, public engagement, really are to benefit people and places beyond the university in terms of knowledge gain, to benefit socially, economically, culturally. The aims are to inform people, to inspire, involve, enrich, to share knowledge and understanding, and with the idea that this benefits wider society, it benefits research and researchers, and it benefits universities as well. So it's very much about a holistic benefit through making access to knowledge and understanding and ideas and skills much more widely available.
Great. Your answer sort of covered really where you think the university's role in this is to a large extent, but now we're in 2021, still really in the midst of a global pandemic. Do you think that university's sort of civic role is changing? And if so, in what way?
Well, it has been changing for the last couple of decades, really. The whole, the importance of public engagement has been soaring up the agenda of institutions at all levels. So the old idea of academics in ivory towers, sort of chiseling away at the frontiers of knowledge in glorious isolation is long, long gone. The role of universities is really changing now because the emphasis is less on the top-down dissemination. It's more about sharing ideas and knowledge and recognising that universities can learn from wider society in the same way that wider society can learn from universities. There's much more emphasis now on everyone benefiting. And there's more increasing emphasis as well on sort of co-production and participative acts. Activity. So enabling people who are not formally within the university to become much more productively involved in the research process, as well as the outcomes of research or indeed of teaching.
So it sounds like from that you think sort of public engagement, yeah, has very much gone, been pushed up the agenda. Obviously the pandemic, we've seen huge beneficial impact of the work by universities and researchers in a very, very direct kind of tangible way. But obviously, where you talk about this changing focus, I mean, universities, certainly in the UK and many other parts of the world, are under increasing sort of financial pressures. Do you think arguably that could have had such an impact that it took focus away from public engagement? But do you think it's actually meant this has become an important part of sort of demonstrating value to justify funding and attract students?
Yes, I do. I think the pandemic has profoundly changed the way in which people have engaged with universities. You know, so much of the engagement that was formerly involved people needing to be physically in place has been able to take part online. And as the pandemic sort of lasted for longer and longer, and the lockdowns, so, you know, we've had this hokey cokey of going in and out of lockdown, people have got more and more familiar with, you know, being able to listen into and contribute to ask questions at public engagement talks or lectures or demonstrations or whatever that have been going on online. And, you know, people, again, you see people all over social media saying, you know, I can listen to lectures I wouldn't even considered them. You know, I can do two or three lectures in one evening and I wouldn't have been able to do that before. I can do two or three lectures in a, you know, different continents on successive days. And it's not just lectures, it's much more than that. Demonstrations, tutorials, learning skills. So I think it's pushed public engagement up the agenda because it's made it much more visible. I think, obviously, as you say, currently institutions are in many cases focused on sheer survival, and students and researchers, particularly the student experience at the moment, is a really high priority because we have a particular responsibility towards our students. But there is an awareness that not only students, but the rest of society is going to need a lot of help recovering from the pandemic, and public engagement can deliver all those sorts of, or so many of the benefits that society will need, you know, the skills, the knowledge, the sense of connection, the sense of aspiration, the sense of having networks, of knowing how to go about taking that step back into the future, that public engagement will be. It's now more visible and it is a priority because it's needed.
Yeah, of course. Obviously, we've got sort of the macro political, economic, social issues, but also, you know, public engagement for most universities, I imagine, is quite specific to them. So, you know, for one university, it may be very different to another, depending on the local community needs as well. And I just wondered how you felt, based on sort of your experience with Pearl at Lincoln, how an institution can get a genuinely sort of true view of local issues. You know, what mechanisms, I suppose, can universities use to reach communities that might be quite tricky to reach or be quite disconnected from sort of higher education?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's really important. And it's not just local communities as well. I mean, as I say, we're universities are connected with, or ought to be connected with, you know, communities that aren't just communities of place, they're communities of identity, they're communities of interest, communities of experience. So whether people who share a career, a hobby, a life experience, a medical condition or whatever, you've got all sorts of different communities. The most important thing, I think, is for universities to ensure that they have people within the universities who know those communities, who are aware of what's going on in them. And you can see that, you can understand how that works in a community of place. You've got people at the university who are living in a place who, you know, are part of the local news, who hear the local news, who, you know, operate within that community, and who have people outside the university who live in that community. And exactly the same applies if it's a community of workplace, or a community of an experience or of identity. But for all of those, it's about listening, it's about being aware, and then it's about sort of, you know, formal surveys. It's really important universities do periodically conduct surveys to find out what do people want, what do they feel they need, what are they interested in, what do they think would improve their lives, or what specific needs do they have. And then, of course, feedback from public engagement activities that take place is really important in terms of understanding what was the impact, did it achieve what we wanted to do, is there something else it could have done, could we be doing something better in the future. So it's really about listening to your communities, hearing what they're saying, and then thinking together with those communities about how to, what the next steps should look like.
Yeah, of course. I mean, as you say, this is not sort of geographically, I suppose, limited, or shouldn't be, certainly. Do you think this, you've already talked about sort of the impact of the pandemic in this light, but this move towards sort of more digital education and communication, do you think this has assisted in that work, kind of widened universities' reach in terms of sort of reaching varying different communities of practice?
I think if you'd asked anyone in a university that 15 months ago, everyone just screaming and tearing their hair out as we were desperately trying to do that switchback overnight adaptation to entirely online teaching. But actually, I think it's been hugely beneficial, because we have all had to get to grips with those digital communication methods. And we've all now got really quite experience with it. And that's not just the case of people in the universities. Wider publics as well are now much more familiar with those digital communication platforms. You know, Zoom is a kind of, you know, has become part of the normal everyday language, really. Mm. And of course, other platforms are available. And that has been really effective for reaching some groups who are geographically very isolated, or indeed are time poor and might have time to, you know, participate in an activity that literally takes an hour from start to finish with no travel time or anything like that involved, but don't have the time to get involved in anything longer. People who are too far away and can't participate. Digital has been brilliant for that. It's also really helped. There are, of course, though, people who, you know, are not connected, who don't have either signal or, you know, internet access, or they don't have the technology, or they don't have the present interest or inclination to engage. And in that case, you know, we've got to reach out in different ways to other sorts of communities, using often person-to-person networks or extensions of those networks, working with third parties, so it might be charities or community groups or social services or medical providers, NGOs. You know, there are different methods for different audiences, but digital is hugely helpful. And of course, there's the fact that activities now that take place online can be recorded. So you can actually record an activity, which might be a tutorial or a demonstration or a talk or a Q&A session. And then you can take that out physically to a community that doesn't have that connectedness, play it on the laptop to an in-person present community, and then use that to enable a disconnected community to engage. So that whole sort of new methods, new techniques has really helped in lots of different ways.
Yeah, that's brilliant. But I mean, actually, the point you make about not almost then, you know, using digital as a catch-all is a really good one, because I can see it could almost sort of swing you know, really far in that direction if people weren't careful. One thing I did want to quickly touch on is just what would you say are actually the common challenges that, say, academics face when trying to bring kind of greater public engagement into their work, and what should institutions do to sort of help them overcome these?
Well, I think the first most people will complain about will be lack of time, and institutions can help that by helping people plan carefully and offering help as well, so for other people to help with activities. A lack of opportunities, people just don't know where to start sometimes. Institutions can help by creating networks that help people speak to each other, by engaging their universities in national initiatives like Being Human and Pint of Science, where individuals can contribute individual activities. Sometimes there's an anxiety that academics feel that they'll be taken less serious if they're seen as doing public engagement, because if you're making your amazing complex research understandable to the general public, it kind of devalues it, because if anyone can understand it, then, you know, is it really worth it? That's a very outmoded view these days, so people just can be reassured that that simply isn't a problem now, or shouldn't be. And then there's the anxiety they don't have the skill set, and institutions can help there by providing advice and support, by giving people the opportunity to start small and then build up skills. And at Lincoln, we have a sort of whole life cycle support system for this that we developed with a UKRI grant initially, so that we have sort of conferences and websites and reports which provide inspiring examples of public engagement. We have CPD, continuing professional development, and advice drop-ins, and a constant, you know, email person who can give advice, and networks where people can build skills and their confidence. We have grants and curated opportunities for people to take part and develop new ideas and put their inspiration into action. We have toolkits for collecting impact data so that people's success can be demonstrated. And then we have awards and recognition to celebrate and reward success, which then encourages people again to go back and have another go, and encourages other people to get involved. So you've got that whole life cycle. I think that's how you can really help tackle these challenges that young academics in particular face when starting to think about adding public engagement to their already very busy timescales.
Yeah, of course. It's that support from sort of start to finish, as you say, that could really make a difference there. One thing I wanted to just very quickly cover before we wrap up is I have heard academics talk about sort of danger, I suppose, of seeming like this top-down Victorian charity model of community work. And I wondered if you had any thoughts on how universities could avoid this and ensuring that everyone kind of meets as equals in these projects.
Absolutely. It's a top priority these days to not do the sort of crumbs from the table sort of approach to just dropping a few pearls of wisdom for people to pick up if they care to. The focus now is much more on sharing ideas. So talking about ideas, asking for people's comments, getting their ideas back on them, and you know, adjusting your ideas accordingly, talking with people, not to people, by asking people what they want and how they think they might benefit from participating in your research or from the outcomes of the research, by noticing how people are responding and by actually drawing people into the research process. I'm particularly interested in participation and co-production in research. As an archaeologist, I had a sort of mass participation project that involved thousands of people over 10, 15 years in excavating within the places they lived to collect data to reconstruct the historical development of those places, which actually, as a byproduct, produced evidence of the impact of the worst pandemic of all, the Black Death in the 14th century, on ordinary everyday places. But that participation has also benefited people, and we've worked out what the benefits are, and we've done surveys and evaluations to explore what those benefits are and how they impact. And, you know, we've now got before and after evidence of the impact that it has on all sorts of beneficial attitudes. So people's perceptions of social support, their life satisfaction, place attachment, positive emotions, just through taking part in research, which is both developing skills and giving them a different perspective on life. So that's very far away from that top-down model of, here's some knowledge that if you're already very engaged, you'll enjoy reading, but you know, otherwise you won't. It's about giving people the chance to really transform their lives by getting that sense of enjoyment and interest and being intrigued in the world around you and feeling connected with people leading, doing different sorts of things, having a sense of future that could involve something very different to what you're doing now. It's really about trying to ensure that the work of universities really does benefit and transform people's lives and the environment and communities.
Great. Well, I think that's a great place to end on, actually, this idea.
I'm trying to get it to a wrap-up line.
That's fantastic. I think, you know, that's a great place to end around this idea that it's a collaborative and kind of co-creative process rather than one in which the university sort of instructs others. So, look, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been fascinating talking to you. I would love to keep talking and, yeah, delve more into your expertise on this, but perhaps we will chat again in the future. Thank you for your time.
I'd be very happy to do that.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
So Carenza ended there with some really useful ideas on sort of collaboration and this idea of co-creation of research projects with external parties, so whether that's organisations or individuals, as a way to kind of do it in a very sort of equitable way and avoid this sort of top-down Victorian model of charity.
Mm. Really interesting pointers from both Jeremy and Carenza. That's all we've got time for today's episode. Thank you so much to Carenza and Jeremy for speaking with us for this show. And Miranda, we have even more tips from academics right across the world in our latest Spotlight, don't we?
Yeah, that's right. Our Spotlight collection showcases actually a real wealth of advice around how universities can kind of better engage, support and inform communities beyond their sort of physical boundaries, and you'll find that at timeshighereducation.com/campus.
We certainly hope that will be useful to everyone who is considering their place in the community as they are starting to reemerge from the pandemic. Thanks so much for listening. Miranda, good to see you. Thanks for coming.
You too. See you soon.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.